John F. Kennedy entered office inexperienced but alluring, his reputation more given by an enamored public than earned. In the new book, Incomparable Grace, JFK and the Presidency, presidential historian Mark Updegrove offers readers a new assessment of his tenure in the Oval Office, revealing how JFK's first months were marred by setbacks, the botched Bay of Pigs invasions, a disastrous summit with the Soviet premier, and a mismanaged approach to the civil rights movement. But the young president soon proved that behind the glamour was a leader of uncommon fortitude and vision. Mark Updegrove is the author of Incomparable Grace. He is presidential historian for ABC News and also the author of five books on the presidency. He currently serves as the president and CEO of the LBJ Foundation, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Mark Updegrove to the roundtable this morning. Mark, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Of course, you're a presidential historian and serve as the president and CEO of the LBJ Foundation, as well as the presidential historian for ABC News. What brought you to want to look at the presidency, the short presidency of JFK?
You know, John F. Kennedy is considered one of our great presidents, both as far as historians' evaluations go and the American public. But you know, there's the old expression, write the book you want to read. And while I've read some good books on John F. Kennedy, I've not read a book like this. I really wanted a brisk take on John F. Kennedy's very turbulent, triumphant in many ways, tragic in other ways, but ultimately consequential presidency. As you see Kennedy in all his flaws and in all his potential, striving to meet the moments of his presidency at a time when we are at the height of the Cold War.
You say this in the book, and it's interesting, but he is a complicated leader. How so, and how did you look at that in putting that into a context?
No, I wanted the reader to see the very human John Fitzgerald Kennedy. He has been so mythologized with the Camelot lore in the years since his presidency, and I really wanted to cut through that and show you who Kennedy was in the moment, the flesh and blood Kennedy. He is very complicated. He desperately wants to make his mark in the presidency. He not only wants to be president, he wants to be a great president and stride the stage as FDR once did and as de Gaulle and Churchill did before him. He wants to be that kind of presence, but he's also battling his own demons. We know that he was a womanizer, a very reckless womanizer. We know he had health problems that he wasn't particularly forthcoming about with the American public. But he also wants to, again, do the best for his country at a time when America is transitioning. And there's a struggle for Kennedy, but I think he ultimately achieves his potential in the presidency, but it takes a while.
You write about this, but it was JFK's father, Joe Kennedy, who was really focused on having his son be in the White House, especially after the death of Jack's older brother, Joe Jr. So what was it about that idea of having a Kennedy in the White House that was so important for Joe Kennedy, and what ultimately became important to Jack Kennedy?
You know, Joe Kennedy is Catholic at a time when Catholics were persecuted in this country. They were treated largely as second-class citizens, not to the extent that African-Americans were, but there was a glass ceiling in place for Catholics, societally and politically. And Joe Kennedy wanted nothing less than to be the first Catholic president of the United States. And he knows he can't do so without great wealth. And so he becomes the nation's youngest bank president in his mid-20s and amasses a great fortune over the years. And then aims at politics. He asks Franklin Roosevelt, who he has helped politically, if he can become ambassador to Great Britain, which is a wonderful story that I tell in the book in and of itself. But he goes to Great Britain on the eve of the Second World War, and he goes from it with an isolationist stance. And that makes him a political pariah at a time when we ultimately get into World War II with the bombing of Pearl Harbor. It's very much against the isolationist Joe Kennedy. That said, his two sons go into war, Joe Kennedy Jr., his namesake, and John F. Kennedy. And Joe Kennedy Jr. does not come back from the war. He dies in Europe when his plane goes down. And so the ambitions that Joe Kennedy had for his son, his first son to be president, are then heaped on John F. Kennedy when he comes back from the war. But it's important to note that while Joe Kennedy wanted John F. Kennedy to become president, John F. Kennedy also wanted to become president. It wouldn't have worked otherwise. It suited John F. Kennedy's ambition. Again, he wanted to go into public service. That was part of the Kennedy family ethos. And so he becomes a congressman at the age of 29 in 1946, goes on to the Senate 4 years later, and then sets his sights immediately on the presidency, which he wins in a whisper with 0.2% advantage in 1960 versus Vice President Richard Nixon. So it was definitely Joe Kennedy's ambition to have his son achieve the presidency, but it suited John F. Kennedy's ambition as well.
He was ambitious. He had great confidence. You write in the book that the failed invasions in the Bay of Pigs really started to shake that confidence, but ultimately helped make him stronger. He learned from that.
He did. The Bay of Pigs, of course, was the we backed Cuban nationals in their attempt to overthrow Fidel Castro in Cuba. We lost 114 Cuban nationals in that failed incursion, as well as 1,200 being taken captive. And this is in the eyes of the world when John F. Kennedy is in the fledgling stages of his presidency. And he knows that Nikita Khrushchev, the premier of the Soviet Union, is watching, and it reinforces his view of Kennedy as weak. It bears mentioning that while Kennedy achieved the presidency, as I mentioned earlier, with less than 1% advantage in the election, that 83% of Americans support Kennedy in that moment of great defeat with the Bay of Pigs. 83% approve of his job performance. Only 5% of Americans disapprove of his performance. And I think it's America, I think, putting its support in John F. Kennedy in this very vulnerable moment. We realize that the Soviet Union might be emboldened by this. And I think that's a confidence vote that we've picked the right horse in John F. Kennedy in the presidency, despite the fact that he makes this major blunder early on in his administration.
You say that Khrushchev said this, considered Kennedy too intelligent and too weak.
This is after the two had a summit. So again, Kennedy has that major failure in Cuba with the Bay of Pigs, and it reinforces this notion that that Khrushchev has, that Kennedy is callow, that he's inexperienced, that he's out of his depth in the presidency. And that impression is reinforced when the two meet face-to-face in Vienna for a summit between the Soviet Union and the United States. The entire world watches this. This is at the height of the Cold War when there are palpable tensions between the superpowers. So we watch this as we would like a great heavyweight championship bout with the premier of the Soviet Union going toe-to-toe with the president of the United States. And Kennedy admits afterwards, after these two grueling days of meetings with the very pugnacious and truculent Nikita Khrushchev, that he has been savaged by Khrushchev, that he has been gotten the better of. So as Khrushchev leaves Vienna, he is further emboldened and sees Kennedy as too intelligent and too weak. Too intelligent meaning he sees Kennedy as this effete Ivy Leaguer who might be book smart, but is not street smart and is not strong. And that leads to the great gambit by Nikita Khrushchev in shipping nuclear arms to Cuba in what would become the Cuban Missile Crisis. 13 harrowing days that were the closest we have ever come to having a nuclear war.
One of the things that I would like to ask you about, because of your knowledge of LBJ, and as I mentioned, you were director of the LBJ Presidential Library and currently serve as the CEO of the LBJ Foundation. What was the relationship between those two men? And in the book, you talk about that when JFK offered Lyndon Johnson the vice presidency, many didn't think he would take it.
Well, because Kennedy was considered a lightweight in the Senate, where Lyndon Johnson was the almighty Senate majority leader, perhaps the most powerful Senate majority leader we've had in the history of our country, certainly the most powerful Senate majority leader of the 20th century. So for Johnson to take the second spot to John F. Kennedy, a backbencher in the Senate, was surprising. But I think Johnson took it because he realized that if he didn't take the vice presidential nomination, that the ticket didn't have a chance. It needed Southern balance. Southern Democrats needed somebody that they could relate to. And the very Brahmin elitist John F. Kennedy, in the eyes of many Southerners, wouldn't cut it. So the addition of Lyndon Johnson helped enormously, and LBJ was aware of that. For Kennedy, I think Kennedy also realized he needed the Southern balance. He certainly needed to give Lyndon Johnson respect, and that was one way of doing it. But more importantly, he knew that if something were to happen to him as president, Lyndon Johnson was in a good position to take charge. Lyndon Johnson instinctively understood power. He understood the way Washington worked. He could get things done. He knew intuitively what to do. And that's, in fact, what happened when John F. Kennedy was struck down by an assassin's bullet in November. LBJ takes over and knows exactly what to do in those moments.
And you write that the relationship is cordial, even though Bobby Kennedy and LBJ famously did not get along.
You're right. The Kennedys are not monolithic. Joe Kennedy, the Kennedy patriarch you mentioned earlier, Joe, had enormous respect for Lyndon Johnson because Lyndon Johnson so, again, intuitively understood the way power worked. And anytime Jack Kennedy, as senator from Massachusetts, needed to get something done, he had to go through Lyndon Johnson. So he had respect, maybe begrudging respect at times, but great respect. Bobby Kennedy absolutely despised Lyndon Johnson. He thought he was uncouth and crude somebody who couldn't be trusted with power. LBJ saw Bobby Kennedy as somebody who wouldn't be attorney general but for barefaced nepotism. Somebody who was weak, somebody who had cozied up to Joe McCarthy, worked for Joe McCarthy during the height of the McCarthy era. So the two had great contempt for one another. And that, I think, really affected the way that that Lyndon Johnson was treated by Kennedy acolytes. John F. Kennedy, again, I think had respect for Lyndon Johnson, maybe grudging at times, but respect. But the Kennedys those around Bobby Kennedy saw Lyndon Johnson much the same way that Bobby Kennedy did.
Following the assassination of JFK, Lyndon Johnson is able to work on the Civil Rights Act and put it into law. This is something that is interesting because, as you write in the book, JFK had a very complicated history with the Civil Rights Movement.
Yeah, he was very. He moved on civil rights, but he had to be pushed. The majority of Americans didn't see the urgency in pushing civil rights, and neither did John F. Kennedy, who was far more interested in foreign policy and saw the civil rights movement's exposure to the ravages of racial prejudice as tarnishing America's image abroad as we battled for moral high ground in the Cold War. It was hard to say that we were a better system than communism when we were treating many of our citizens as second-class human beings. So Kennedy didn't act on civil rights as much as he reacted, though he finally stepped up on civil rights by calling it a moral issue in the spring of 1963 and proposing the Civil Rights Act, banning racial segregation JFK exercised little political muscle in attempting to pass the bill, which had languished upon his assassination. It takes LBJ, with his enormous understanding of the legislative process and using the martyrdom of Kennedy's assassination, in order to plow the Civil Rights Act through Congress in 1964.
What was the relationship like between Kennedy and Martin Luther King?
Martin Luther King owes Kennedy big in 1960, because when Kennedy is campaigning for the presidency, Martin Luther King is jailed in Atlanta and soon shipped to a southwestern prison. A prison rather in southwestern Georgia. And it's an extraordinarily dangerous situation for MLK. There are mostly white rural prisoners there and white prison guards, and his very life is at stake, Martin Luther King's, at that point. And Kennedy calls the Democratic governor of Georgia and asks that Martin Luther King be released. So Kennedy, or rather King, very much appreciates that. His father certainly does, and promises Kennedy a suitcase full of votes, in his words, from the black community, which helps Kennedy enormously in the election. But once Kennedy becomes president, as I mentioned, he's very cautious on civil rights, and King keeps on pushing him with these various stances that the civil rights movement is taking to expose Americans to the virulent problem of race in this country. It's not until the campaign in Birmingham, Alabama, the most segregated city in the United States, where we see images of fire hoses being weaponized against civil rights activists, and German shepherds lunging at others on the front lines, that John F. Kennedy steps up, makes a very compelling speech before the American public, much of it extemporaneous, and elevates civil rights to a moral cause. At that point, Martin Luther King says that white boy hit it out of the park.
You quote Jackie Kennedy in the epilogue as saying, "So now he is a legend when he would have preferred to be a man." I guess it's impossible to predict what would have happened had he not been killed on that day in Dallas. But in your view, in looking at this, how do you think he was headed, and even the direction of the country during what became an incredibly turbulent time?
It's so hard to say, but it's easy to romanticize John F. Kennedy and think he would have taken a different course than his successor. There were inevitable vicissitudes and tempests ahead for John F. Kennedy. He would have had to take a stand in Vietnam. There is this great myth that JFK would have taken a different course in Vietnam. There is no evidence of that whatsoever. In fact, 2 months before his assassination, he says it would be a deep mistake to withdraw the advisors that we had placed in Vietnam and bring them back home. He subscribes to the domino theory and says that, which says that if the communists take Vietnam, there could be other southeastern nations and other nations across the world that could fall in turn. So there's no evidence whatsoever, except anecdotal, that John F. Kennedy would have taken a different course than Lyndon Johnson. What we do know and can infer is that John F. Kennedy was very careful not to engage militarily. He takes a very prudent course when the wall goes up in Berlin, which is perhaps the most dangerous spot in the world at that time, the wall that divides East Berlin, which is communist controlled, from West Berlin, which is part of the Western community. He allows Laos, does not bring troops into Laos, another Southeast Asian nation, which threatens to fall to communism. And, of course, we know he averts what might have been nuclear war in the Cuban Missile Crisis. So there's no doubt that he would have been prudent, But would he have withdrawn troops from Vietnam? There's no great evidence of that.
Mark Updegrove is the author of the new book, Incomparable Grace, JFK in the Presidency. The book is published by Dutton. Mark, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Incomparable Grace. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.